The following Burl Report podcast is made possible through support from Biotech 2014, Transforming Healthcare. Burl Media's 28th annual report on the life sciences, available now at burlmedia.com. I'm Daniel Levine, and this is the Burl Report. The rising cost of specialty drugs continues to be a battleground between drug makers, healthcare providers, and payers over the cost of innovative therapies. Express Scripts recently did a study that suggested more than $9 billion will be wasted by U.S. health plan sponsors in 2015 and separately added 66 exclusions to its formulary that included several newly approved and high-profile drugs. We spoke to Steve Miller, Chief Medical Officer of Express Scripts, about striking a balance between innovation and cost, how waste in the system can be addressed, and whether and when biosimilars will begin to curb rising costs. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Express Scripts recently issued a report saying U.S. health plan sponsors are expected to waste more than $9 billion on specialty drugs that provide no additional value. That's a significant increase over the $4.9 billion in waste estimated in 2011. Can you begin by walking us through those projections and how you arrived at those numbers?
Yeah, this is actually that it's not that the drugs aren't effective, it's the channel by which people are receiving the medication. There's a lot of medicines that could be either self-injected or given in an infusion center that are currently administered in a hospital or a doctor's office. And so moving patients to the right place of care, where they're actually happiest with the care, where it's the safest environment, but where the charges for the drugs are most appropriate, can save the country an enormous amount of money.
So going from $4.9 billion to $9 billion seems to be a huge jump. Why the sharp increase?
Yeah, the big difference is, as you know, hospital chains are actually buying up physician practices. And so what we're seeing is that the charge for specialty medications administered by doctors is actually going up disproportionate to just the inflation on the drugs. So when a hospital owns an infusion center, their reimbursement is much, much higher than if that infusion had taken place either in a freestanding center owned by a physician, or even better yet, if the patient actually can self-administer in their own home, even if it's with the assistance of a nurse.
So, you know, I think we get numb to the big numbers in the world of healthcare. On one hand, $9 billion doesn't sound like a lot when you consider the $2.7 trillion healthcare spend in the United States. Can you put $9 billion into some perspective and the role specialty drugs are playing in the rising cost of drugs?
Yeah, so if you think about it just in the view of drugs, we spend about $300 billion a year on pharmaceuticals in the United States. And so that $9 billion is 3%. And so that's an enormous opportunity in which you're actually, it's all considered waste, because anytime you're spending a dollar that's not making a patient any better, any safer, then it's wasted money. And in this particular case, it's total waste. And so getting patients to the right channel for their specialty medications is almost as important as getting them on the right dose at the right time for the right duration. And so it's a great savings opportunity for the country because it's literally better care at a lower cost.
So in terms of specific steps, what is Express Scripts recommending as a way to curb that waste? How do you change the channels, as it were?
Yeah, so we have a program called Medical Benefits Management in which even though we are not administering the drug, it still can be administered by the physician, we will actually do the prior authorization. And the reason why we're able to do it so well is on the pharmacy side of your benefit, we use a system called NDCs to categorize the drug. The NDC number of a drug not only tells us what drug it is, but it tells us how much of the drug is in the container and actually what type of container it is itself. Is it a vial? Is it a pen? Is it an infusion? And what happens is the hospitals use what are called J codes or U codes. It tells you that the drug was used, but you have no understanding of how much or how it was given. And so what happens is, I'll give you a great example. Let's say you need 10 milligrams of a drug. At the hospital, they can sell you one vial of 10 milligrams. They can sell you 10 vials of 1 milligram, or they could use a 20 milligram vial, use 10 milligrams on you and 10 milligrams on someone else. And the payer community has no clue what they're being charged for. At the pharmacy, using these NDC codes, we show exactly that it's a 110 milligram vial, and we can tell them exactly how much we reimburse for that vial. And if the physician says, I can't even buy it that inexpensive, we even have a distribution company that will sell it to them so they can still make their profit, their ASP plus six, but the patient gets it in the right setting, and the health plan or the employer that's paying for it saves an enormous amount of money.
So I would argue that you view the problem as not only the channel, but also the fact that drug companies are producing drugs that don't necessarily have the value that they're commanding. You recently offered a list of 66 exclusions from your formulary, including some well-known high-profile newly approved drugs. What was the rationale here, and what was the criteria in determining whether a drug should be excluded?
Yeah, so we always have to put clinical first. So we have a totally external pharmacy and therapeutics committee made up of 19 physicians across every subspecialty. And when they decide what's on our list or not, these formulary lists, they actually do not have any information on price. The only information they're provided is what's the quality of, you know, is this drug useful in the treatment armamentarium? And so can any patient that's treated by any doctor for any condition be treated with this list of drugs? Pharmaceutical companies tend to fall in love with their product, always believe that there is the best, but this committee uses essentially the FDA filings and all the publicly available information on a drug, including what's provided by the manufacturer. And they say, is there data that one drug is better than the other? So all drugs are put into one of three categories. If a drug is truly unique, it's called a clinical include. You have to have that drug on the list. And usually the manufacturer knows it's unique. We know it's unique. The patients, the payers know it's unique. And in those particular cases, we're a price acceptor. And that's about 15% of drugs. On the other end of the spectrum, there would be clinical exclude. These would be drugs that despite being available in the United States, have not been pulled from the market by the FDA, have very little role in healthcare. So I'll give you an example. Old antihypertensive drugs that you have to take three times a day. They haven't been pulled from the market, but they probably don't have a role. And these represent less than 1% of drugs. But 85% of drugs are what are called clinical optional. You need to have drugs that treat those conditions, but you may not have to have a particular drug. So if there's 10 penicillins on the market, the P&T committee would say, we need to have a penicillin, we just don't care which one. This gives us the opportunity to pit the penicillin makers against each other and say, if you want access to our membership, who will give us the best price? So when we go through the exclusion process, those drugs that have been excluded from our formulary had competitors in the marketplace. In fact, it was so clear they had competitors, almost every one of them even had coupons. And pharmaceutical companies don't offer coupons unless they know people could be moved to something else. And so we were able to pit some of even the newest drugs against competitors, get better prices for our patients, but never jeopardize their clinical outcome.
And in terms of savings, any estimation on how much this might end up saving your customers?
Yeah, so we started this last year, and the savings for last year for the exclusions was about $700 million. That continues on through this year, but we now get an additional over $300 million. So we'll be saving Express Scripts clients over $1 billion this year by excluding just a handful of drugs.
Well, the pharmaceutical industry often justifies the high cost of new drugs by the high risk and expense of R&D. Is this a reasonable justification? Is there a case to be made that innovation and investment is going to dry up if drug prices are reined in and new drugs are excluded because they're high cost relative to the value they produce?
You know, this is a great point because, you know, we have a phenomenally innovative pharmaceutical industry and we never want to lose that, and there's still great needs out there. But, you know, it's a cyclical business, and right now the pharmaceutical industry and the biotech industry are doing phenomenally well with near record profits, and there's 5,400 products in human testing, more than at any time in my career over the last 30 years. And so the model is changing. So the big pharmaceutical companies, the historic giants, are struggling because they're entering an era where many of their products are losing patent protection. And it's really the biotech and smaller companies that are coming up with these innovations. And so what happens is the big companies that are sitting on all this cash are actually cutting out their own R&D. And you've seen repeated announcements of how they're downsizing their R&D. And they're essentially buying up or buying products from smaller companies as they come through phase one and phase two. So they're deleveraging their risk. But the model is not at a point where it's sustainable, because what's happening is the price of new products coming to the market is awfully high. And we have to figure out how we're going to get to a sustainable model, because this pricing it at whatever the market will bear is just not a sustainable solution.
What could drug makers do better to work with payers to avoid the situation where they have gone through a long development cycle, win approval, and then find their products face exclusion? I mean, what advice would you offer a drug maker?
Yeah, so what we've started doing is we've actually gone to the pharmaceutical manufacturers and said, listen, we need to start having conversations earlier in development. So when you're in phase two and you think of heading to phase three, we need to probably sit down and you give us your thoughts, we'll give you our thoughts of what we think the payer community can tolerate. So we're not talking about we're trying to drive them down to the lowest possible cost. We're talking about what's a sustainable solution. And to our pleasure, we've had a tremendous number of pharmaceutical companies take us up on this. And we've had more meetings with pharma companies about their pipeline in the last couple of months than we've had at any other time in our company's history.
So are they prepared to hear a message at the end of phase two that your drug doesn't look any better than what's on the market, so don't bother taking it forward?
Well, you know, what they really appreciate hearing is they understand they fall in love with their own product. But they find this to be a necessary dose of reality of how the payers will look at it. And so I think that we want them to bring new products to the marketplace. We want new cures. We want something out there for Alzheimer's or new antibiotics to come to the marketplace. And we understand that there's a cost to this innovation, but we also need them to understand that when they're dealing with a product that has huge populations, so a good example is the most recent battle on hepatitis C. When you have 3 million plus patients in the United States with it, you're going to have to price it differently than you're pricing for a rare disease when there's only 1,000 patients for it. And so we're trying to work with them, trying to give them our perspective. Now, they don't have to take our perspective, but we think it's going to be useful for them, and we see several of them responding in a very positive way.
We've seen some experimentation with what I would call pay-for-performance models of pricing, whether it's through refunding payers if drugs don't do what they're supposed to, or some other ways of discounting or offsetting the cost of a drug based on how effective it is in a specific patient. Do you see these pay-for-performance models being any kind of a solution or taking hold in any way?
Yeah, so we've toyed with this, as have others, and as you know, there's always a lot of fanfare around the introduction of the experiment. We haven't heard too much about the outcomes of them because, unfortunately, it doesn't work very well. And the reason is this, things are usually not black and white. So you could probably do pay for performance for an acute infection where you say, did I cure that infection, yes or no, and pay there. But even in the case of Valcade in multiple myeloma, it's very hard to look at all the surrogate endpoints and say, is the patient responding to this or not? And so even the Valcade experience hasn't been that favorable from a pay-for-performance standpoint. So unfortunately, because the measures, agreeing to the measures of outcome are so difficult, and because there's factors like patient adherence and other things, we have not seen much success in this particular area, but we continue to push.
At the same time, we've seen a very slow move towards the introduction of biosimilars, at least here in the United States. What role do you think that's going to play in terms of curbing the cost of specialty pharmaceuticals?
Yeah, as you know, we've been campaigning for biosimilars for now over 8 years. We're really excited that the FDA has finally received some applications. We're really hopeful that the FDA will come out with additional guidance in the coming months on things like naming and other things. We published a study in which we looked at 11 products that could potentially be made in biosimilars and introduced into the U.S. market. Over the next decade, that could save the country over $250 billion. When you think about that, that's an enormous amount of money that can be, is fungible, could be used to pay for, you know, the newer products that are coming out. So we actually think the introduction of biosimilars is crucial if we're going to get to a sustainable model.
And do you see something happening near term to accelerate that, to finally make it a reality?
Well, I think that the pharmaceutical companies, by putting in these applications, are really forcing the FDA to come out publicly and say, what are they going to do about certain of these issues? And so I think that the fact they have applications is going to move the process forward in an accelerated way. Because if you think about it, it's been years since the FDA has been given the right to regulate biosimilars, and we still haven't had much guidance out there. In the EU, they've had these drugs on the market for over 6 years. They've been saving patients enormous amounts of money, been saving the system enormous amounts of money, and it's been safe and effective. And so we need to, as a market, truly get in the game and catch up to Europe and the rest of the world. Great opportunity for our healthcare economy.
Steve Miller, Chief Medical Officer for Express Scripts. Steve, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And a reminder to our listeners that Biotech 2014, Transforming Healthcare, Burl Media's 28th annual report on the life sciences, is now available. To order a copy or download a free sample, go to burlmedia.com. Thanks for listening. For information on Burl & Company events and publications, go to burlandco.com. And be sure to join us at theburlreport.com for the latest news and analysis on the life sciences industry. Sign up for our free e-newsletter, the Burl Weekly Brief, by hitting the sign-in link at the top of our website. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Burl Report and at DS Levine. And thanks to Jonah Levine for providing the Burl Report theme.